We'd like to welcome everyone this morning. For most of you anyway, it's still morning, to the Ag and Uncertain Times and jointly sponsored by the American Agricultural Economics Association Extension Section webinar. Today's webinar is a series of presentations intended to assist agricultural professionals and extension educators and other practitioners to prepare for the challenges that are developing in agriculture. Today's webinar will cover three topics. We're going to cover some livestock and grazing policy outlook and implications for 2013 and beyond. We're also going to have a presentation on a climate overview and a forecast as we approach the 2013 cropping cycle. And then we're going to wrap up with a presentation more for the crop production sector, crop policy outlook, with some implications for insurance and disaster programs as we look ahead to 2013. I'll be the MC for today. I'm Rodney Jones, and I'm with Oklahoma State University, an agricultural economics specialist. I'll serve as the host for today's webinar. I'm only able to do that, though, with a lot of help and assistance from many others who are working behind the scenes to help bring this webinar to you and make these presentations possible. Most of those team members come from the western states, and without their support and the support of the institutions where they work, these webinar offerings would not be possible. Today's speakers, today's presenters are going to be Dr. David Anderson from Texas A&M University, Dr. Elwin Taylor from Iowa State University, and Dr. Vincent Smith from Montana State University. I'll provide a little more detail, a little more in-depth introduction to each of these individuals as we begin the program here in just a few moments. Let me first explain how participants in the webinar can forward questions to our speakers. The process we'll follow is to have you as participants enter any questions you have into the little chat window box that you find in the very lower left-hand side of your screen. Once you've typed in your questions, you'll click on the button to the right of that question box. It will be submitted and conveyed to our background team. Those folks on the background team will forward those questions to me to present to the speakers at the appropriate time, either at the end of their presentation or some of them we may withhold until the very end of the webinar. We would also encourage that if you are experiencing any difficulties in participating in the webinar, whether that be audio issues or any other issues, you might let us know through that same chat window so that some of our team members can try to assist you as best they possibly can. One other thing I might mention before we begin the first section of our discussion today, if you'd like for the slide to show up larger on your screen, if you're having a little bit of trouble viewing the slide material, you can click on that full screen button, which is in the upper right-hand corner. If you'll move your mouse over that section of the screen, you'll be able to highlight the full screen button. The chat window will disappear, and the slide will appear larger. Of course, if you want to go back to the window, which has the chat window, and give you the opportunity to ask some questions via the text box, you can simply click on that button again to bring back the screen that has the option of asking questions in the text window. We do have a few questions that we would like our audience to respond to on your computer screen as we begin the webinar. Just take a few moments, please, to help us find out a little bit more about who is on the webinar today. And also that will help us as we plan for future webinars. So the first question is, we'd like for you to tell us just a little bit about yourself, just in general, what is your primary occupation? In answering this question, we would like for you to click all of the possible answers that apply in your situation. Perhaps more than one might apply. For question number two, we would like for you to tell us where your main place of business is located, what part of the United States, or if you are an international participant in our webinar, we would like to know that as well, to again give us a little bit of feedback regarding who is participating in our webinar today. Third, we would like for you to tell us whether or not you are currently a member of the American Agricultural Economics Association Extension Section. Please answer yes or no. Now, our intent here is to provide a service to the agricultural industry. We would just like to know how much we are reaching out beyond just the membership in the Extension Section. And we'll talk a little more about the Extension Section a little bit later on in the webinar. And finally, last, including yourself, we'd like to know how many individuals are participating in this webinar from the home or office location where you're sitting. In other words, how many are participating on your particular computer login. It's often very convenient for more than one individual to congregate in the same office or the same conference room to view the webinars together. We encourage that. However, the information that you provide by answering that question will help us have a better handle on the total number of participants in the webinar. So thank you for the answers to those questions. With that, I'd like to give you a little bit more detailed introduction of our first speaker. Our first speaker today is Dr. David Anderson. David is a professor and extension economist in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Texas A&M University. His research and extension activities are in livestock and food products marketing, ag policy. He focuses on issues that are relevant for Texas producers. He's a Texas AgriLife Extension Livestock Food Products Marketing Economist. His program is focused on research in the impact of alternative programs, farm programs, on the livestock, dairy, and crop sectors of agriculture. Dr. Anderson has done research and provided extension information on the wool, mohair, and dairy policy. Recent extension programs focused a lot on market outlook, animal identification systems, country of origin labeling. He also teaches an agricultural applied policy analysis course, primarily at the master's level. Dr. Anderson received a couple of degrees in agricultural economics from the University of Arizona, then earned his PhD at Texas A&M. Prior to returning to Texas A&M in 1996, he did work for the Colorado Agricultural Extension Service in the Livestock Marketing Information Center for a couple of years. He's received numerous awards for professional excellence, including awards from the American Agricultural Economics Association, the Outstanding Extension Program Award from both the Western and the Southern Agricultural Economics Associations, and the Texas A&M University Deputy Chancellor's Distinguished Performance Team Award for Research and Extension. Remember, as we go through the program, if you have questions for Dr. Anderson, please type them into the chat box, and we will forward them to Dr. Anderson at the end of his presentation or at the end of the webinar. Dr. Anderson?
Well, thanks, Rodney. I don't believe I know that guy that had that big long introduction. But, you know, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with everybody today. It's great to see so many participants and so many also friends and colleagues joining in for this. And I appreciate everybody that makes this session work, and thank you for all your work in this area. I'm going to cover a little bit about livestock policy update, livestock and grazing, and in keeping with the theme that of ag in uncertain times and drought. While I'm not going to address drought really directly, I do want to preface my comments in that, you know, I think 2013 is really a key year or a pivotal year for our livestock and dairy industries because of drought. With so much of the country in drought conditions, so much of our grazing lands stretching into our corn and soybean areas, whether we rely on grass and range and pasture or we rely on purchased feeds, I really can't help but think 2013 is really a critical year for the direction of our livestock and dairy industries. So, you know, with that, I'm going to hit kind of two broad areas, a little bit about the Farm Bill, and then other policy. You know, so much of livestock, as we deal with, whether we talk about commodity programs on the crop side, are so many of our livestock policies aren't those kinds of policies. There's other things. So I'll provide a few thoughts there, maybe, you know, kick off some thinking in a lot of those areas as well. If we look at the Farm Bill, really as kind of this first area, you know, rather than talk about the old Farm Bill, which is new again with the extension, I think I'll try to keep my comments really sort of to the Farm Bills, and I have an S on that slide, really, because we got two bills out there. While we have an extension until whenever that changes, we've got some House and Senate versions out there that may or may not change, and we got a long ways to go to see where those fall out. But I think what's interesting, you know, if we look at the, whether it's the House or the Senate Farm Bill that are, you know, in limbo, pending, wherever they are, if we look at the last Farm Bill, there was a livestock title, I think, for the first time. This time around, in there is not a livestock title in either bill. If we look at the livestock title last time, it largely dealt with competition issues, market issues, directions to GPSA to do some work. Most of the explicit comments, though, were dealing with poultry industry issues. That whole title was pretty controversial in livestock circles, and some livestock segments of our livestock and dairy industry worked pretty actively to get rid of it. And so neither bill has a livestock title. If you look at Title 12 in the miscellaneous title, there are several authorizations, one dealing with feral hogs, which is a big deal for Texas and the South. Several items in that miscellaneous section. I should mention, too, dairy's a separate beast, and I say that I'm actually in Atlanta today for the Southern Dairy Conference, and it's dairy's a different beast, so that's all I'm going to say about dairy, I think, is just that, and certainly it has its separate title with a lot of controversial issues for the industry going on in the Dairy Security Act, so I'll leave that there. I think too, one of the comments I think that has been talked about a lot is in terms of risk shifting as we look at the policy climate for livestock. You know, I think we might argue that the current direction has resulted in risk shifting. As we think about the crop insurance in response to, for crop farmers with crop insurance as we hit the drought, certainly in 2011, the driest year on record in Texas, and then the drought last year in 2012, there's some risk management or risk protection there through crop insurance that we really don't have significantly on the livestock side. When I hear this term risk shifting, I guess I would say I'm not sure it's any different than ever before, given that we've had commodity programs, but we are, you know, if we look at what's in the two farm bills, there is more of a feel of a crop insurance type of safety net program there, and certainly that is, if we think about this risk shifting notion, I'm not sure it's a lot different than any ever before, but you know, this crop insurance feel or type of programs for commodity programs, I think at least leaves us, you know, thinking in that direction. And how do livestock producers, how are we going to continue to deal with these types of risks? Again, on that risk shifting theme, you know, we do have some insurance products. Gross margin, using dairy as an example. In fact, in about an hour and a half, I'm doing a presentation at this dairy conference on LGM. We've got livestock risk protection or LRP available for several livestock species. the pasture rainfall and forage insurance product, I think has been used with some real success to help producers, certainly in Texas over the last couple of years with our drought issues. So there are some products there. Certainly in livestock, we have a different set of issues as we look at some of our species with integrated production. The issues are different. The risks are different. So in that regard, it does affect how we look at those, how we really, what risks are we shifting, what are we mitigating, and how do we manage some of those, I think, are key issues there. So, just putting that in mind, I should say one other thing is that one of the issues in this is that in livestock, we've had, for these livestock insurance products, we've had about $20 million allocated for the premium subsidy or the underwriting portion from RMA, and that gets used up pretty fast. It's given the volatility. If we look at dairy, for instance, it's pretty easy to see how we've used up that money before the end of the fiscal year in the past and been unable to offer some insurance products. So certainly that funding level is a critical issue as to how we're going to deal with these with livestock policies that provide some risk protection going forward. Let me say a few things about a bunch of other things. Animal ID, the final rule from APHIS USDA was published on January 9th, 2013. This has been a very controversial topic in livestock circles, particularly cattle, I think less so in dairy. But particularly in the cattle side, this has been a very contentious issue for a number of years, and USDA has gone back and forth and back to the drawing board, and now we've come out with this final rule. And if you start digging down into it, it really sets minimum national animal ID documentation requirements for livestock moving interstate. So if you're going between states, there's a set of documents there. But as setting a minimum, it leaves a lot up to the states as to how they're going to do that. For western states, if you look at this rule, brands are recognized with a brand inspection certificate if the receiving and shipping states agree that that's sufficient. I think that's a big change from past proposed rules on animal ID. Feeder cattle are exempt. They're going to be handled under a separate rule, and that's really cattle under 18 months old. Is that rule, and they are exempt from this rule. So really we're getting at breeding stock for this animal identification rule. And like I said, it leaves a lot up to the states. I'll give you an example from Texas. As of January 1, our animal identification system was put in place. All intact adult beef cattle and buffaloes or bison 18 months and older are subject to this, and Mexican origin event stock. So if you got some roping steers hanging around, roping steers are subject to this rule to move them around. So as identifications require a change of ownership, there's a number of types of tags that are acceptable for identification in the state. Interestingly enough, in Texas, in the Texas rule, a ranch brand registered with the county is not acceptable as official ID, though it is accepted for ownership. And the key there is in Texas we have county registration of brands, and so you could have the same brand in different counties, and so therefore you don't really have ID that goes along with that, and that's different from other western brand states. So, I think this is one we're going to continue to see a lot of contentiousness certainly in the beef cattle areas as we go forward. But I think that Texas example compared to what's in the national proposed rule is kind of an interesting example. RFS, as a livestock economist, I would do a disservice if I didn't mention the RFS, particularly with more than 100 dairy producers downstairs who are still cranked up about this. But I think, as we all know, a temporary waiver was not granted. I think most analysis showed or indicated that a temporary waiver would have done little to reduce corn prices in the short term. But I think we have to remember that what has been a significant push to higher corn prices over the last several years to the benefit of many corn soybean producers has really been disastrous for our livestock industries, and we're continuing to go through that adjustment. And I would say that I don't think this issue's gone away. Where we go with ethanol, where we go with the RFS, and that whole host of issues is not going away. A host of other stuff, whether we talk about antibiotic use, public land use, public land grazing, and regulations on that, animal welfare, what I would call a production process, rules, regulations, whether government or market participant enforced production process rules, I think we'll continue to see more of that in 2013, and more searching how this is going to shake out, whether from interest groups, consumer groups, broader interest groups and the like. Market issues, I put that there simply because we do have more consolidation going on as we look at the beef packing industry. We've got some more consolidation happening there. We've got market issues across that spectrum. And things like market and price reporting, market news, how we report and do we report market prices in their current form. And more is just my catch-all for all the host of things that are going on in livestock industries. And I think that's my last slide. So hopefully that's provided a little food for thought, a little direction here, and I'll turn it back over to you, Rodney, as our host.
Well, thank you very much, David. We do have a few questions for you.
I was afraid of that.
two of them are related to dairy, and I will ask them first, and then the third is maybe a little more general in terms of livestock. But the first question related to dairy is, I guess in your opinion or your analysis, how effective is the livestock gross margin for dairy program? How effective has it been for dairy producers? And do you see that being expanded as a part of any new Farm Bill resolution?
To the end of that question, do I see that being expanded? I believe it was proposed, I don't know how far it's gotten, but to expand that pool of money as part of livestock insurance policies from to that $20 million to $50 million. I don't know how far that's gotten offhand, but I know that was being proposed. But certainly, if that whole host or area of products is going to be effective or successful, we're going to have the money there to be able to support those and make those work as we do on the crop side. And so that limit, which really started out as a pilot kind of limit on the dollars, I think if we're going to see these being more effective, they're going to really have to expand. If we look at dairy particularly, it's interesting. One of the comments this morning at the conference was that one of the dairy producers said he felt like that he thought there had been a lot of premiums paid but very little indemnity paid out. When we consider that this started in 2008, if I remember correctly, the LGM on dairy, 2009 was probably the most disastrous year financially on the dairy industry that anybody can remember. 2009 was a disaster with collapsing market prices. That was a great time for a product like that, but it was so new it wasn't widely used until later. We get to 2012. We also have had there's some argument whether 2012 has been worse than 2009, but largely because of skyrocketing feed costs crunching that margin as opposed to collapsing milk prices. So I think it's a mixed bag as to dairy LGM's effectiveness. But I think we're still in the process where people continue to try to learn whether it works for them, how it works best for them. But we do run up into that uncertainty at the end of every month on the sign-up day, whether there's actually going to be funds available to even offer LGM. And I think that's a real detriment to its wider adoption.
David, we actually had another question come in from the audience that I'd like for you to address, and then after that we'll probably move on to our next speaker. But the question from the audience is, what do the new rules mean for in-state sales of older cows, like cull cows? what documentation now will be required to take coal cows to, say, for example, a local auction?
Well, if we look at that Texas rule, the Texas rule is, you know, anything older than 18 months old, you know, in a cow or a bull, when they change hands, and the person that has to comply is really on the seller to comply. But when they change hands, so you know, if you raise your own heifers, they were cows, they went completely through their life, and you kept them all the way through the production process. They don't change hands. You don't have to do anything. You haven't sold them. You haven't moved them. Now there is some exemption for. There is some exemption there for direct sales, you know, in terms, if I took it straight to the cow slaughter plant, in that regard, I believe as I look at those rules, they would be exempt. But, you know, for the national rule, it is for, you know, animals moving in interstate commerce. There's a number of ID tags, and there's a lot of changes in the types of tags that are allowable from one of these rules forward, but there's a set of things that are deemed acceptable, including breed registry papers and tattoos and tags and things like that are also deemed acceptable for ID.
Thank you, David. I think with that we'll move toward the next presenter. However, I would mention that if the audience will look in the question and answer chat box section of their screen, they will notice somebody did ask a question about making the presentations available on the website, and there's a website there where the actual presentations are currently available. Shortly after the webinar, the actual webinar recordings will be available on that same site. With that, I'd like to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Dr. Elwin Taylor. He's recognized throughout Iowa, and I might add throughout the country, for his extraordinary efforts as an extension educator. He's received the Iowa Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award. He's internationally known as a scholar of biometeorology, and he's served as a technical editor of several international journals on meteorology. His contributions to the threefold mission of the land-grant university system, research, teaching, and extension demonstrate the breadth of his interest, ability, and expertise. He's received the Excellence in Extension Education and the Excellence in Economic Education Awards. He's received the Iowa Regents Professional Achievement Award. In 2003, he received the Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award from the Iowa Farm Bureau. He's responsible for statewide leadership in the development and implementation of extension education and informational programs on agricultural climatology. He also has some teaching responsibilities both at the graduate and undergraduate level. Unfortunately, Dr. Taylor was unable to physically be with us today. His presentation is pre-recorded. So if you do have questions specifically for Dr. Taylor, his email address is provided on the final slide, and I would encourage you to just email questions to Dr. Taylor individually.
The climate is changing. Climate has always changed and will always change. The question is how much, how fast, and how come? This statement by the leading climatologist on our earth in 1966, when I was a graduate student. That was the question in 1966. That still is. And we look at climate and what it's going on, and people are saying this may be worse than something we've seen in a long time. The U.S. Drought Monitor, the most recent one at the time that I put these slides together, at least, shows a large portion of the country in drought. And when you look carefully at the monitor with its harshest droughts centered right over the area of Nebraska, where they make the drought monitor, by the way, you see some little letters describing the type of drought. Some of the letters are S's, meaning short-term drought. Some are L's, meaning long-term drought. and some are S's and L's, meaning both kinds of drought are there. Well, we have always recognized that there are two kinds of drought. Well, I say always, maybe not always, but at least back into Old Testament times, if we read in the Book of Kings in the Old Bible, or in the Book of Amos, you will read about a drought for want of food, or a drought for want of water, that is, agricultural drought and hydrologic drought, or as we now call them, short-term and long-term drought, so-called because the short-term usually happens first. The precipitation becomes light or absent, or perhaps the temperatures become high, so that crops and plants in general require more water than usual. Rule of thumb, the amount of water demand by a field of crops doubles with every 10 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And so we can get a drought with even normal precipitation. On the slide, you're seeing in the lower right-hand corner the long-term drought. Where it's green, there is no drought. Where it's shades of rusty color, there is long-term drought. That is a lack of water in the rivers, the wells that furnish water perhaps to whole cities as well as to local residents that have perhaps a farm well. And the ponds are likely to be low on water also. The long-term drought does not begin to correct until the agricultural drought in the locality is completely corrected. That is, enough precipitation has fallen that the soil, subsoil we're speaking of here, has become fully recharged with water to its capacity. Then the excess moisture, should another inch or two of water fall on the soil, will either run off the surface or percolate into the soil and percolate right out the bottom into the wells, or perhaps through drainage tile on agricultural land, or in some other way, reach into the ponds or the established flow of rivers. We will not sustain the flow of rivers until the agricultural drought along the rivers, tributaries at least, has been corrected. On the lower left, we see the short-term drought, green areas where there is none because of recent precipitation in most cases, and in the center of the country, some wide areas that is not serious at this time, so they would say, and some locations where the short-term drought is still significant. The Department of Agriculture put out a slide that showed almost all of the country painted red. And those are the counties that were eligible for federal disaster relief, in whatever case federal disaster relief happened to exist during the past year. And the counties with no color in them were not eligible. The red were, the yellow, yes, because they are bordering the drought counties. Well, this is as much drought area as we have ever seen, perhaps the most that we have ever had in the country. But that doesn't mean it was the most serious drought. It is just serious now by our current way of categorizing what is a drought and what is an emergency. Nevertheless, the water year, in the next slide, was shy of moisture in much of the Midwest. I give one example from the center of Iowa, where I happen to live, that has three red arrows showing 3 years since 1950 when the water for the water year, that begins October 1st, because we assume that water that falls after October 1st is adding in to the coming year's water supply for both crops and for rivers and lakes. So the water year, about as low in 2012 as it was in 1998, or as it was in 1956. These were the two very short years of water that we have had since 1950. Oh, yes, there were a couple of equivalents in the 50 years before as well. A couple of things that I want us to notice from this. First, there is an increasing trend in the amount of moisture for the year, about 10% increase since 1970. This is general over the Corn Belt, not really general over the 48 states, but general over the Corn Belt, and has caused considerable change in the climate, able to raise soybeans without irrigation sometimes in South Dakota, as unheard of as that has been, and unbelievable it would have been 20 years ago. But I want you to notice a couple of things about those three arrows. The bad year for driest was not the first dry year in any of the cases, including the one for 2012. And it was not likely the end of the droughty precipitation part of the weather. It tends to go on for another year, or maybe two. In every case that we have observed, at least, of this short of a water year, it's such a big event in the atmosphere of our planet to get this type of a year that it takes months, if not 1 year plus, to get out of the driest and back to normal. And the normal line is on the chart. Also, you see a couple of years that were very wet, and it doesn't take multi-years to get out of the very wet years because there's a very different cause for them. When we look at the 48 states as a whole, we see a very large difference that happened in our country as we've shifted from one type of airflow to another. The top chart shows October of 2009, a map of the country, typical of an El Nino in the way it's configured, although this was a rather strong one for the precipitation that fell in October of 2009. Quite dry in Arizona, adjacent Nevada and California, New Mexico, Utah, parts of Colorado, and much of the state of Nevada. And sort of dry in some other places, all the way down the Rio Grande River to the south end of Texas, for example. Florida and North Carolina, dry. That was significant. Those areas, especially in the Carolinas, will begin to expand soon after this month of October. But you, for the most part, see it was very wet in Southern California compared to usual, and very wet in the Midwest. And there was a little bit of water in some of the areas of Montana. Then there was a shift from El Nino conditions for our planet to La Nina, the opposite condition. We usually consider El Nino the friend of the Midwest farmer and not the friend of the farmland or ranchland of the state of Washington, Idaho, Montana, and some adjacent areas in Canada and in the U.S. as well. But we shifted to the La Nina. This put an end to the conditions of more than 3 years of El Nino-like condition, but was rather dry for parts of the Canadian prairie and for Montana, and things got a little bit rough up there, but then it shifted to the La Nina-type situation, went dry from Texas to Florida and north into part of Canada, but the wet area that developed in Nevada, well, people thought they were going to drown in the Death Valley area and on the Utah border with Arizona, and the precipitation began to become excessive as we went into Montana, Idaho, and Washington, though it doesn't show yet in October. It will be excessive enough that the drainage out of that area will cause significant flooding during 2011 as we go down the Missouri River from Montana through North Dakota, South Dakota, along the west border of Iowa, and the east border, of course, of Nebraska and Kansas, and then across Missouri. And the floods would be significant with that. Well, these two events will show in a graphic form with El Nino in the green at the bottom of the slide, and La Nina, a trouble causer for the past 3 years in our 48-state area at least, as well as much of the world, and the red area at the top, or perhaps it's pink. We moved from dominated by El Nino at the lower left portion of the graph, that by the time we were through August, had shifted into a La Nina, which peaked on October the 10th, 2010, as the second strongest La Nina event in recorded history. Well, it's 130 years recorded history, and it stayed at that high level for some period of time. Then it wavered in 2011 and came back by the time we were to December of 2011, enough to keep the atmosphere of the planet in La Nina conditions. The La Nina officially ended on the 21st of March, 2012, but the weather conditions of the planet still persisted in that condition that brought the drought that we had in many parts of the Midwest and the Deep South until, well, recently. It was still somewhat present. We had hoped that the ship was going to be right into the El Nino. It didn't make it. And now, the end of the chart, we see that we're smack in the middle of neutral conditions and expected to stay in neutral conditions, at least for a few months. But let's look at the picture of the risk that goes along with the La Nina we have been experiencing. The left-hand map shows blue at the top along the Canadian border. That is temperature for January, February, March, colder than usual. So winters are usually cold there, but this is even colder than usual when La Nina is going on. White is about normal, and from Florida to Texas and up the Ohio River Valley area and in between is likely to be on the warm side as usual in a La Nina winter. On the right, we see the precipitation, likely to be very heavy in Montana, and it was, likely to be above usual in the Ohio River Valley. That would be Ohio and southern Indiana and adjacent areas of the country, Tennessee, Kentucky, and perhaps down the river all the way to Louisiana. And drier than usual in Texas, and indeed with this very strong La Nina, it was drier than usual, drier than any year for Texas since 1955-56 drought, which was worse than the one that we had a year ago. Maybe not worse in dollars, but worse for the meteorological measurements and the climate conditions. The risks that we see that affect the Midwest are associated with El Nino, we'll see on our next chart. And on this chart, we'll see a red area in the ocean off the west coast of South America. That warmer than usual water, with colder than usual water showing up as blue north of Australia, is typical of the El Nino event. And in the upper right corner of our slides, we can see the risk wheel. The chance of having a record high yield during an El Nino, this is for U.S. corn production, by the way, is the green area in the risk wheel. The yellow area in the risk wheel is above trend line yield, but still not record high yield. Blue is below trend, but not drought. Red is drought. With an El Nino, there's a 70% chance that our nation will enjoy a corn yield above the trend line. And really a pretty good chance it might set a record high yield. The opposite of El Nino is La Nina, where the water is colder than usual off the west coast of South America, along the equator, and north of Australia it is warmer than usual. When we have this condition, we have a 70% chance of a below trend line yield. On the graphic, I have put in the trend line yield, where yellow meets blue, 160 bushels the acre. If we have normal weather across the nation in 2013, we would expect to have a normal yield or a trend line yield of near 160 bushels. However, the more likely yield, if an La Nina is going on, is 147 bushels the acre, and the chance of a drought being less than 144 bushels the acre for corn is very significant. Of course, in 2012, the corn yield was 123.4 bushels the acre, according to the USDA, right in the middle of the serious drought, but still a 70% chance of being below trend in a La Nina year. The current picture of what's going on with ocean temperatures, the next slide, shows that blue is beginning to make an incursion right on the equator off the west coast of South America and all the way to the international dateline in the center of the Pacific Ocean. And if that becomes increasingly blue, that is colder than usual, and increasingly, let's say, rosy to red north of Australia, we could be right back in the La Nina-type conditions, which we saw during the past 2.5 years. Well, we hope that isn't the case. But as the next slide shows, the tendency, if we don't know where we're going, and there's no real reason to think it would go one way or the other, on the left part of the graph of the multivariate ENSO index, it showed that things moved into blue between 1950 and 1976 or so. That is, the droughty for the Midwest and wet for Montana. La Nina, just because it occurred most of the time. So if you didn't know if El Nino or La Nina was coming, it would go one way or the other, but probably during those years to the harsh side for the Corn Belt. During the next years, from 1976 up to 2000, six or seven, the tendency was to be dominated by the favorable for the Midwest El Nino side of things. We have shifted back, it appears, on the lower right of the figure, to we would have to anticipate, if we're at neutral, that the tendency would be to go back to what we would call the unfavorable for the Midwest, at least, condition of La Nina. And that might be considered favorable for the Canadian prairies and for the Montana area, where the winters tend to get more snow. The next slide has to do with the volatility of yields. You see right in the middle of the slide, over 1980, a great deal of volatility of yields from year to year. This for Iowa. It looks a looks the same, although the actual bushel numbers are a little different if we looked at the corn yield for the nation. Years of volatility. Also, it was volatile around 1940, before and after, all the way through the middle of the 50s. And then I have some brackets in there that show some years of very consistent yield. Consistent, but increasing over 1960 period. And the yield going up, and not much volatility from year to year. By the way, there wasn't much volatility in your winter heating bill or your summer cooling bill if you were a person that cooled in the summer. And the same was going on over the year 2000. I have a dashed line that touches the top of all of these yields. That is the realized potential yield for corn. If the national corn doesn't come up and hit its dashed line, the Iowa corn yield doesn't come up and hit this dashed line, it was because the weather was not ideal for the crop. And you see, it's only been ideal a few years. But I want you to look at that time of volatility over 1980. It was 25 years. The one over 1940 was 25 years. The one off the left, before stable period number two, was 25 years. The first time of high volatility was 25 years. For some reason, we've had four of them since we began keeping records in 1864 or so, and they've all been 25 years in length, with four periods of consistent yields, 18 years in length. The year we have just experienced was year 19. We have reason to think we're about to go into 25 years of the volatility that you see expressed over 1980. All of the risk management that you have done with crop management, with cattle management, with using insurance, with choosing fertilizer, with choosing hybrids, choosing rangeland to use, all of this risk management, including especially your insurance program, has just been practice for what we expect during the next 25 years. That is without any climate change. That's just what we expect with the climate we've been living with for the last 100 years. Some people say the climate is changing. Don't expect that that would make it less of an effect. Well, the climate has always changed. It will always change. The question is how much, how fast, how come. But during the next 25 years, we do anticipate that we will be in a very different type of climate from what you experienced the last 18, but not extraordinary. We do know how to handle it. Well, if you'd like to contact me, there is my email address. I always put changes on Twitter, just a sentence, but you can click on that sentence and see a page full of details. I hope that your risk management goes well.
I'm not really sure whether to say thank you or not. I'm not really sure whether I'm very encouraged by that presentation, but yes, we are thankful for Dr. Taylor's time and that insightful presentation regarding the situation that we're in and what may lay ahead. Again, Dr. Taylor is unable to join us live today for questions, but he did provide his contact information there on the slide, and feel free to email Dr. Taylor directly if you have questions for him. With that, I think we'll move on to the next presenter, our third and final presenter today for this webinar session is Dr. Vincent Smith. He's a professor of economics in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University, co-director of the Montana State University Agricultural Marketing and Policy Center. He received his PhD from North Carolina State in 1987, bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Manchester, 1970 and 71, respectively. His current research emphasizes agricultural trade and domestic policy issues with a focus on agricultural insurance, commodity markets, risk management, and again, agricultural trade. He's authored and edited 9 books and monographs and published numerous articles, book chapters on agricultural economics, agricultural policy, and other economic issues. In 2008, he became a distinguished scholar of the Western Agricultural Economics Association. And in 2011, he received the Bruce Gardner Award for Outstanding Contributions to Economic Analysis Work. With that, let's welcome Dr. Vincent Smith.
Well, thank you so much. And like our first speaker, I don't recognize that person that you just described, except that I feel very old. Let me get right to this. The 2013 Farm Bill is an animal about which I believe we have no clue. We have some straws in the wind about where policy will go, but at this stage, we have not got one single clue about what that bill will look like. And that's sort of disturbing, but sort of exciting, but not for producers who want certainty. What's the current farm bill situation? Well, we have the extension, as discussed earlier, which was built into the January 3rd fiscal cliff law, and that was an outgrowth of negotiations between Vice President Biden and Senator Mitch McConnell in the Senate. House leadership had considerable input on the extension of the 2008 Farm Bill. Almost surely, that was why any initiatives on dairy programs was killed stone dead. So what's the current Farm Bill situation? Well, the Biden-McConnell compromise extended the 2008 Farm Bill provisions for all programs. However, programs for which funding was not included in the 2008 bill for the 2012 crop year, those programs were simply not refunded, even though the Senate bill that came forward had funding for several of those programs, particularly the disaster aid programs, other than the short program for crops. the short program, as it is, as it existed, is almost surely dead now, and was not included in either the House or the Senate bill that were discussed and passed at various levels in June, May and June and July of last year. The unfunded programs critically include all of the permanent disaster programs established in the 2008 Farm Bill, and I'll discuss those in a little more detail. But they also included programs targeted to specialty crops, organic farming, research, and marketing. Funding for that set of crops currently will not be available for 2012-13, and that's causing heartburn for some of the land-grant universities who receive quite a lot of that funding. Drought policy issues. Well, as an economist, I have to draw a supply and demand diagram with apologies to people who don't like that stuff. We know that the drought has sharply curtailed production of corn and soybeans, and as a result, those prices have jumped. A consequence is that in areas that have not been so subject to drought, prices of crops that are relatively close substitute, this includes wheat, which has obviously got a derivative feed use, have also shot up. The irony here is that the shift in supply, which has driven up price, has led to the circumstance that all of the farmers who purchased the revenue insurance product from RMA that has embedded in it the harvest price option will actually generally receive a higher income than they expected to receive when they planted their crops. And that's one critical reason why expected farm income is only minusculely lower than last year's net farm income, which was a record amount. So the great irony of the drought, which has had a significant effect on crop yields, we've got corn supply approximately 15% lower than it was last year, is that in fact most farmers are enjoying financially, if they bought the insurance, and over 90% of corn farmers did buy such insurance, near record or record revenues, and certainly very high profits. So other than farmers who chose not to insure their corn and their wheat and so on, farmers, because of the revenue product, are actually financially sitting in a very comfortable circumstance. Now, there are some farmers that are not, and of course those farmers face considerable difficulty. But they are a very small number relative to the majority. This picture came up earlier, just reflects the drought conditions. It's virtually the same picture that you saw, and I'm going to skip right by it. What do we know about agricultural insurance and drought in the context of the new Farm Bill? Well, no changes are proposed as yet in the federal crop or forage insurance programs. In both the Senate and the House bills, premium subsidies were intended to remain in the same ranges. Pasture range forage would continue to be available for forage. There's some indication that at some point a CAT coverage may be introduced in PRF. Revenue insurance with a harvest price option will continue to be available for corn, wheat, and other crops with futures markets or whose market prices are closely linked to such crops. And yield insurance will be available for most other crops where you can do that. Then there's a plethora of other products for orchards and so on that RMA has developed. They're very lightly used, as it turns out, but they'll remain available. Now, there is a question. Because leadership in the Senate has changed on the Republican side, that is, Senator Roberts has stepped down as the ranking member, and Senator Thad Cochran has stepped up. Senator Roberts was a very strong advocate for crop insurance. Senator Cochran has had a record of being somewhat less interested, seeing it as less relevant for his constituents. And that raises the possibility that if substantial cuts to farm subsidy spending are agreed upon in a sequester-related package, that insurance subsidies might come back onto the table. That's contingent on how big any cut that the Senate and Ag committees will be required to make will be. What about drought assistance programs in general? Well, things that will remain in place, emergency loans will continue to exist. They were funded through 2012, and they're likely to remain available in any new farm bill. The disaster set-aside program that provides producers who have existing direct loans with FSA who are unable to make the scheduled payments to move up to one full year, move up one full year's payment to the end of the loan, that program is likely to remain available. It is available for this year. NAP, the Non-Insured Crop Disaster Assistance Program, which provides financial assistance to producers for non-insurable crops, that program will remain in place. Now, that program is only available for commodity crops where the catastrophic risk protection level of crop insurance is not available. So that's not everything. It is rangeland, however. The importance of NAP for farmers, for ranch farmers and ranchers who are concerned about lost forage, and the availability of funding under the disaster programs is significant. I'll discuss that in a moment. The SURE program is not funded, and it's unlikely ever to be refunded in that sort of form. Some form of new shallow loss program of the form, for example, included in the Senate bill may become available. Again, whether or not there'll be any new shallow loss programs or a price loss coverage program, which isn't really a disaster program related program directly at all, whether any of those programs will come into place, again, depends on how much in any sort of expenditure reduction package that the Congress and the White House agree on has to come out of agriculture. What livestock disaster aid programs are not funded? These are important programs for many producers. Well, livestock forage program, currently not funded. Livestock indemnity program, currently not funded. The emergency assistance for livestock, honey, bees, and farm-raised fish program, ELAP, not funded. And though I don't mention it here, the TOR program also is not funded at this point. However, it's very clear that the Senate and the House and the White House all agree that there should be a livestock disaster programs. These programs are likely to be refunded in any farm bill that is developed over the next 6 months, and it is quite likely that the funding would be retroactive to losses incurred in 2012. They're also likely to be of funds eventually for losses in 2013. Some of these programs require producers to have purchased either NAP or crop insurance for their crops. So particularly for those with grazing land, having NAP coverage may be a critical component in ensuring that they would be eligible for drought-related forage loss programs if refunding occurs, which most observers think is very likely. Emergency haying and grazing of CRP acreage can be authorized by the Secretary under certain conditions. Certainly that took place this year, and that program is likely to continue in any new farm bill, and it's certainly the provisions of the 2008 farm bill for that issue are continued. What do we have right now that is funded? These are not really directly drought-related programs, or, apart from average crop revenue, the acre program. While the direct and counter-cyclical program, funding is in the farm bill for that program right now. The Secretary has indicated concerns about whether it will continue to be available. The acre program, funding for the acre program, which really triggers payments when at the state level revenue per acre falls below the target level, that program is funded right now. There are question marks about whether the program will continue to be funded. And the Secretary of Agriculture has indicated there are some concerns here. What about a 2013 farm bill? Well, it's very likely to be developed, but it's clear from statements from both the chair of the House Committee and the Senate Committee that no work will be done before March 1st, and now more likely April 15th. by those committees. The committees are likely to be given a new budget cut number by the House and Senate leadership. They were operating under the assumption of a gross cut of $2.3 billion a year, $23 billion over 10 years in 2012. There likely will be a new number, and that number could be anywhere from $1 billion to up to $7 to $10 billion. That's going to be negotiated between the overall leadership in the House and the Senate and the agricultural committees. In a new farm bill, we know direct payments are likely to completely disappear. It's quite probable also that the ACRE program will go. The question is whether there will be new subsidy programs like the price loss coverage program and the supplementary coverage option for insurance that are embedded in the House and Senate bills, and as well as the shell loss program. If there are monies available from the $5 billion currently being spent on direct payments for a new program, then there's going to be a fight between the Senate and the House committee, although the promotion of Thad Cochran to ranking member in the Senate gives more influence to southern states, which means peanuts, rice, and cotton, than they had in the Senate previously. Livestock programs, as I've said, are likely to be refunded in 2012 and 2013. And that's a very quick cook's tour of where we are with respect to the Farm Bill, with respect to policy innovation, and with respect to programs that directly impact crop producers facing drought. And thank you for your patience and your willingness to listen.
Dr. Smith, we have a question or two that has come up. As you mentioned, the direct payments and the ACRE program have been basically reauthorized for 2012, given the extension. However, there's been some discussion that the direct payment could ultimately be cut, even though it's been authorized, just because of budget issues, even for the 2012 year. What's your thoughts on that?
The payments for the 2012 crop year, so that's crops planted in 2011 and 2012, have already gone out. So the question is, what will happen for crops planted in 2012, harvested in 2013? And the answer is, we don't really know. Almost surely, if there is a farm bill agreed to by the House and the Senate, even though the extension has funding for direct payments that would go out October, November of 2013, the extension provisions would be overridden, that's quite clear, by a farm bill. That if that farm bill ends the direct payments program, it may end it so that payments that were going to go out in October of this year will not go out. That's one possibility. The other possibility about which there's been wide discussion is the following. There is real concern about the lack of funding for the livestock disaster programs. The livestock disaster programs would have been funded in the Senate version of the fiscal cliff legislation that was not completely accepted. They would have been funded at about $600 or $700 million. It is conceivable that over the next 6 weeks, Congress will pass legislation to refund those programs. But to keep the funding budget neutral, the monies would perhaps be taken out of the direct payments program so that you'd be looking at somewhere around a 15 to 16% cut in the direct payments checks, assuming that they were actually made in October of this coming year. It's just not clear that will happen, by the way, and the Secretary has been very clear that there's a lot of ambiguity here about what will happen when as most observers believe, a 2013 farm bill is finally agreed to by Congress. Does that help?
Yes, and I did mean the 2013 farm bill as I asked the question. Kind of related to what you were just talking about, and as I'm asking this question, the final participant questions are being posted for webinar participants. We would ask participants to answer those questions as best they can. But one more question for you, Dr. Smith. You mentioned there's been quite a little bit of pressure for the livestock indemnity program and the livestock forage disaster program to basically be reauthorized for both perhaps 2012 and maybe even moving forward to 2013. What about the related program, the SURE program on the crop side?
It's dead meat. Sorry to be so crass, but there's no support being Senator Baucus and Senator Harkin for that program, perhaps Senator Grassley. The program would be replaced by a shell or loss program if there's passage of a bill. There's no indication of any interest in either of the committees by a majority of the committee members in refunding that program. And the clue to this is what happened in the Senate bill and the House bill in May and July. The SURE program was not included there. And when there was an initiative to pass a disaster aid program, the only focus was on the livestock indemnity, livestock forage, ELAP, and tree and orchard programs. And SURE was intentionally, I believe, explicitly excluded in those proposals.
Thank you. We do have one question that I'd like you to address very quickly from the audience. You mentioned that eligibility for many of the disaster programs required NAP insurance. The question from the audience is, doesn't pasture rangeland and forage insurance, or PRF, make ranchers eligible for those disaster programs just the same as NAP?
It does. You can have – this is a great question, and – I mentioned that because PRF is not available in every state, but you can have either PRF or NAP to be eligible for the disaster payments. And parenthetically, you can have both in many states. You can have coverage from both the NAP program and the PRF program because of the pilot status of the PRF program, and so the questioner is entirely correct, and I really appreciate that being brought forward.
Well, thank you, Dr. Smith, and I'd like to wrap up here by thanking all of our presenters today, Dr. David Anderson, Dr. Elwin Taylor, Dr. Vincent Smith, outstanding presentations on agricultural policy, on the as it relates to both livestock and forage producers, and as it relates to crop producers, and kind of a weather outlook there for Dr. From Dr. Taylor. I believe with that we will we'll go ahead and wrap up. But one point that I would like to make is, if you're not a member of the American Agricultural Economics Association or the Extension Section, which is a subgroup of the American Agricultural Economics Association, I'd ask you to consider joining at www.aaea.org, or you can go to that website to learn more about both the association and the associated sections. If you do have any further questions or if you have suggestions for future topics or future presentations, send us an entry in the chat pod before you log off, or send an email to information@farmmanagement.org. That's information@farmmanagement.org. Or if you're still logged on, just send us a note in the little chat window. As mentioned earlier, both the recordings as well as the PowerPoint presentations and other information are available at the Ag and Uncertain Times website, which can be also be accessed from the AAEA Extension Section website. So if you're interested in a copy of that information, or if you know someone who would like to hear today's presentation sometime in the future, they can log on to that website and listen to that recording. That'll be posted very shortly. Previous webinars are also posted on that same website on a variety of topics. With that, I think we'll conclude today's webinar, and I'd like to thank everyone for attending, and we'll see you on the next webinar sponsored by the Ag and Uncertain Times Group and the American Agricultural Economics Association Extension Section. Thank you very much.